Hey everybody, it's Vince Gill. You're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, señores and señoritas. This is Chris Shiflett. Welcome to another fine edition of Walking the Floor, your favorite podcast. Gosh darn it. I just got home from tour. I got a nice month at home in the summertime. I could not be any happier. Sun's out. Beach is beautiful. There's no waves, but waves are coming. Waves are coming. I want to thank everybody that came out last weekend in Chicago. Played two killer solo gigs there. At Chop Shop and at Uncommon Ground, as well as in Cleveland at Beachland before that. Such fun. Thanks, everybody, for coming out to those solo gigs. I got a bunch more coming up. I just announced one today on the 20th of August at the Redwood Bar in Los Angeles, California. Going to be opening for Garrett T. Capps, which will be a hoot. Then I'm playing up in SB, but I think that one is sold out. And then I'll be coming through Seattle with my good friends, the Royal We, at the Sunset Tavern on September 2nd, I think. And there's still some tickets left for that. And a couple days later, I'm down in Portland at the Landmark Saloon. And I think there's still a handful of tickets for that. And then there's some more stuff coming down the pike. Detroit, I think Detroit is sold out at Small's Bar. But I don't know, show up maybe that you can sneak in the back door or something. And there might be something coming up in like Calgary. We're trying to find something in Milwaukee, but haven't nailed that stuff down yet. So more plans to come, and this is all to kind of get ready for a lot of touring next year that I hope to be doing, and a new record coming out and all that jazz. It's a good time. Okay, let's pay some bills. Zounds.com. You know them, you love them. It's your online one-stop shopping for all your music gear needs. There's no application process, no interest charged ever. You just pay your first monthly installment and your gear ships immediately. Every order, $599 and above, is eligible for their exclusive 12 payment plan, man. So get over there, Zounds.com. And support for Walking the Floor also comes from D'Addario. D'Addario, a fine maker of USA-made instrument strings and musical accessories, is committed to sustainability through the Playback program, recycling over 1 million used instrument strings. For more information on the Playback program and how to help in its mission of reaching 2.5 million strings in 2018, visit playback.d'addario.com. Okay, let's get to this week's interview. Well, holy moly. Hang on to your hats. We got a big one this week, and I mean a seriously big one. I'm talking to country music legend, icon, Vince Gill. You know him, you love him. It's the Guitar Slinger. Let me tell you a little story about how this interview came about. Okay. So we were in Boston on tour, and I heard that the Eagles were also in Boston, and they were staying in the same hotel as us. So just on a whim, I just cold called Vince Gill, because I've been wanting to interview Vince Gill for ages. He's one of the best guitar players ever in the history of any genre of music, but he's a country machine, man. Anyway, I cold called Vince Gill, and to my surprise, he actually called me back, and I was like, hey, man, I'm the dude from the Foo Fighters. Could I interview you for I got this podcast? And he was like, no problem, but I'm watching the golf. Can we do it after? And I was like, great, let's do it. So next thing you know, Vince Gill's sitting across from me in my hotel room at my little table there, and I got my mic set up, and I'm asking him all these questions. We covered, like, everything from how he got started through becoming a solo artist and touring with the Eagles and all the stuff he's got coming up, which this is actually good timing because I just noticed today he announced a bunch of tour dates for the fall. So this is a busy guy. And he was so cool to take time out, you know, on an afternoon, on a day off, when he could have just been chilling watching the golf. And instead, he came over to the shifter's room and sat and talked with me. And hopefully someday I'll be able to corral him into giving me some guitar lessons. Fingers crossed. All right. This is Vince Gill on Walking the Floor.
Just a bunch of them I can't answer. Too stupid.
It's always the problem interviewing somebody like yourself is you've just got so much. There's so much to talk about because you've got a long career. But I'll start with I interviewed Paul Franklin recently.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he actually played. I just recorded a new album out in Nashville.
Okay.
He played all the steel on it, and then
he's something, isn't he?
Oh my God, he's amazing. But you know, everybody knows. Like, any guitar player knows that pedal steel is like the hardest instrument in the world. You know, it's just a crazy version of guitar playing. And I know you've got a long history with Paul, but have you ever given that thing a whirl?
Yeah. I was always nuts about the sound of the instrument. To me, it's the one instrument that kind of can emulate the human voice better than any other. And I was always drawn to the instrument. A lot of my guitar styling was emulating steel guitar.
Like copping steel licks?
Yeah, exactly. How the bends worked and bending down and up and everything about it was just so musical and like I said, reminiscent of singing. That's why I was so drawn to it. And I bought one when I was 18, I think, and started learning to play. And I was a decent dobro player. I could play dobro. I played a lot of the bluegrass instruments in my teenage years and was fairly proficient on most of those instruments. But the thing that I couldn't get the hang of with steel guitar was the string spacing. Because the string spacing
was...
It's such a weird order, right? Well, just the space in between the strings
was
so narrow compared to either a guitar or a banjo or a mandolin or a fiddle or a dobro. All those other instruments, the string spacing was wider. So I never did know what strings I was going to get a hold of. it was kind of maddening. I played steel guitar in Ricky Skaggs' band.
Did you really?
As an 18, 19-year-old kid.
Really?
And we were all just struggling to make a living, and we were in a band together for a short period of time. But
Was that before Pure Prairie League?
Yeah.
Okay.
Several years before that. And we called it a mercy selling when I finally got rid of that instrument.
There's nothing more humbling. I mean, I own one.
Yeah.
But I will not say I play it.
It's staggering what it'll do.
Yeah. You know? Well, that's why those guys are all nuts, because they had to sit there for like 30 years and figure it out alone in a room somewhere.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I drive Paul nuts. And there was a fellow that played with me for many, many years named John Huey, who was a great steel guitar player, spent a lot of his years playing with Conway Twitty in the 60s and all those great early, really traditional country records that Conway made. That was John Huey playing steel guitar. And I hired him back in the, I guess, late 80s to come play with me. And that was unbelievable. But I drove him nuts and I've drove Paul nuts because my mind understood kind of how the instrument worked, but not entirely.
Would you have them slow it down so you could cop them?
No, I wouldn't try to play it. I was just, as I was composing, you know, solos and things, I'd say, can you make that note then go? And they just would shake their head. And I have a lot of fun with that instrument, and it's pretty definitive to me, of what makes country music.
Sure.
The banjo defines bluegrass music. I think the guitar defines rock and roll. To me, the steel guitar defined country music.
Right.
And maybe the horn. Maybe a horn defines jazz. I don't know whether would be true. It'd be piano. But
it's interesting in country music how at certain times, certain instruments that you associate with it get sort of like shunned.
At one point,
the mandolin or the banjo, you know, these things. That's too old timey. We're not doing that now. You know?
It's true. You know,
that doesn't seem to have ever happened exactly to the steel. Right?
Well,
I guess it has.
And a lot of the steel players would be kind to credit me with making the instrument do what they all wanted to be able to make it to do, but no one would let them. It became more of a part instrument that kind of played string pads. And, we don't want that whiny thing. We don't want that whiny sound. And I was always gaga over that sound.
That's the sound.
Yeah, it was a record of mine called When I Call Your Name was my first big breakout record, and Paul actually played the solo on that record, and he loves that I tell this story on him all the time, but he had played the solo, and it was fairly pedestrian, you know, just kind of, it didn't, you know, it didn't do a whole lot of the great things that, to me, that a steel guitar would, and I called him, I said, hey, would you do me a favor, and would you replay the solo on this song? And he goes, well, I really liked what I played. And I said, well, I respect that. But I said, I want the instrument to cry and whine and do all the things that a lot of people don't want it to do anymore. And I'm of the other ilk where I want it to.
Right.
And he begrudgingly came back, and then that song went nuts and kind of changed my life and my career. And he finally came to me and says, I am so grateful you asked me to replay that solo.
Right.
It's an iconic steel guitar solo.
Well, he was like conditioned to people not wanting that
exactly
sort of thing
right
anymore. Uh-huh. You know, right.
And you get in that trap of just trying to do what you know people want you to do, you know, and maybe I don't know that that's safe, but it's smart.
Right.
You know, but yeah, we've got a long history, me and Paul.
So you're out with the Eagles right now.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like, is that a long-term thing, or is that, are you just filling in, or are you just kind of signed up for?
As long as they want me, I guess.
Right.
You know, it's something that I couldn't have dreamed up,
right,
you know, in my life. And I think I really have it in a great perspective. Is I wish I wasn't doing it, because if I wasn't doing it, it would mean that Glenn was still around.
Right, right.
You know, and he was a great friend of mine for years.
Have history with the Eagles, like back in the day, like in the Pure Prairie League days?
A little bit. A little bit back in, like, when I got out to California. I moved out to California in 76 and was 5, 6, 7 years behind all those guys getting
right
out there and running at the Troubadour and all the same places. And never did cross paths with them much, but did later on. Then, and when they broke up in 80, my manager Larry Fitzgerald was managing Glenn during the solo years.
Right.
So we had a lot of occasions to cross paths.
Right.
So all that being said, I kind of have always tried to be as beyond respectful as I could about getting to do this. You know, it was a great thrill,
sure,
but the only reason I'm getting to do it is because of something that tragic happened, you know. And I think that as it goes on, what's interesting is I can feel it from people. You know, when I start singing Take It to the Limit, or I start singing Lion Eyes, I see them just kind of like going, I'm not so sure about this, you know. We're pretty used to hearing Glenn sing these
right,
songs.
Right.
And then after a few verses or a chorus or two, I can feel the room just kind of go, it's okay.
Right.
I think we really are here because we love these songs.
Right. And this guy clearly loves these songs, too.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. You know, and I don't think it's a real stretch that I'm in this band, the way I play and the way I sing.
Yeah, no, it makes sense.
All of that. It makes pretty good sense. So it's been a real, real blessing.
And so when are you going to get back to your solo stuff?
Like, I'm doing some stuff this year. Last year, I cleared out my calendar because I knew for a little while that we were going to take a stab at going out and playing, but I wasn't supposed to tell anybody. So I was like lying to my friends for months. You know, hey, I heard a rumor that you. I said, oh, weird.
Yeah,
I don't know what you're talking about.
Meanwhile, you're woodshedding the guitar parts
in
here, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But
that's got to be fun to play some of those guitar leads, man.
It is, but I, you know, the truth is, I'm not getting to, and it's okay because they've had Stuart for 18 years. Stuart Smith has been in that band along with Joe and. And I knew going in that it wouldn't be a big guitar chair for me, and that's cool. You know, it's kind of more up my alley. I'm not quite so so versed in doing the same thing. You know, they like things as those records are,
yeah.
And then as you do it,
a lot of those leads
are
kind of parts.
They are, and they're just as iconic as the songs.
Yeah,
And for all those reasons, it's exactly as it should be. So
yeah.
I don't have anything but a pretty okay attitude about not getting to play much, so
right,
I don't mind a bit. And they needed a singer more than they needed a guitar
right
player. So
do you have a new solo record in the can, or how does that work for you?
Yeah, I've got a new record that's almost finished, and I'm not sure when it's going to happen, but I did clear out my calendar last half of last year. I worked the first half of the year with my band and toured and did gigs and all that, just not knowing how much they'd want to do. And they wound up doing 9 or 10 dates.
Right.
And So then this year they came and said, hey, we're going to go do 60 dates. And I said, cool, I won the lottery. Let's go.
Right. It's a good
and
problem to have.
So they're going to take August off and November off, and I'm going to go out with my band for about 25 or 30 dates in those 2 months.
When you make records, like how are you writing all the time, and then when you just have, you know, 10 or 15 songs that you like, you go, okay, it's time to make a record? Or do you sort of write in batches for, you know, with a theme sort of for each record?
Well, it used to be, you know, in my knocking it out of the park days, you know, we're having a bunch of hits and all that. I would always go get ready for a record, you know, every year or two. I knew I'd need to make a record. So yeah. I would carve out some time. Now, not so much. Nobody knocked on my door to get my last 4 or 5 records. So I can take my time and just kind of do whatever. And I write when I feel like writing and store up a few songs.
Yeah.
I did something that was so much fun, the record called Bakersfield with Paul Franklin.
Yeah.
That I went way out the norm. I wanted to kind of, I guess more than anything, stick up for some real traditional country music.
Sure, sure.
That there isn't much of it anymore, you know. And so
Something in the air right about that time. You did a Bakersfield record, and a couple other people did too. There's some, I don't know what it was, but like that was like percolating right in that moment. You
sure.
know?
And it's, you know, if you look at the history of this music, hillbilly music, country music, whatever you want to call it, it just keeps revolving. You know, it comes back to its roots and it strays away and go back to the 50s. All the country stars were trying to be crossover kind of pop singers.
Sure.
And big, lush, ballady kind of records.
Yeah, with the strings and the choirs and all that
and
stuff.
And then the 60s turned up and it was a little more hardcore, a little more barroom.
Yeah.
I heard Haggard say it about as good as anybody. He says, you know, really, country music's either coming out of the church house or the beer joint.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And that's really about it. You know, the two things that were... to me, the how it all got started, the first records that were ever made in country music were the Carter Family, which represented the church, and Jimmy Rogers, which represented the blues.
You know? Right.
And that's how it all kind of got its start.
How did it start for you? Like, what gave you the bug to start playing? You grew up in Oklahoma, right?
I did. I grew up, and my dad played a little bit, and his mom played a little bit, and I remember them playing, and I don't remember a time when I wasn't trying to beat a song out of a guitar, you know, and
so guitar came first.
And I was lucky in that I was the youngest in my family, so I had my parents' records, I had my big brother's records, I had my big sister's records, and so I got a really nice, diverse palette.
Right. What were those records?
Who were blues records? My brother loved the blues. My mom and dad loved, you know, a lot of the country stuff, be Patsy Cline or whatever was kind of going in the 50s and 60s. And my sister was a little folky rocker. And, you know, we'd had James Taylor's first record and we had the Eagles' first record. You know, just on and on of all that great stuff. So I had a pretty adventurous palette for music. And I was more of a rock and roll kid in my early days of playing. And a lot of, all the school bands we'd play from school dances or mixers. We were playing Rocky Mountain Way, and I'm looking over there at Joe and getting to play it with him every night. It's like,
how cool
is that going on here? You know, I got a tape of me singing "Peaceful Easy Feeling" as like a 15-year-old kid, and it's awful. I haven't had the guts to play it for the guys yet. You know, but
they'd be like, "I don't know, man. I don't know if this is the right
choice. I don't think this is the right guy." I sang lower back then, which was really weird.
Really?
But, yeah.
Oh, funny.
But
it's like the finding your voice thing.
Yeah. I liked anything. I was crazy about guitar players. So
who were the sidemen guitar player dudes in the honky tonk bands from back then that you picked up on?
Well, it took me a while to discover the country world. Maybe later than anything else. Like I said, I was a typical kid. You know, I was loving what Clapton did, what the blues players did. Like I said, my brother listened to a lot of blues records and. Jimmy Page or Jeff Beck or that whole 60s.
Stones and all that.
Exactly, the Stones or John Fogerty. Just anything and everything. I was like a sponge. You know, when you're a kid, you're trying to take it all in.
Sure.
And then I got bit by the bluegrass bug, which never saw it coming. I had broken a string on my father's banjo, and I knew I'd catch hell if I if he came home and I'd broken a string and I didn't know how to change a string on a banjo. So there was a fella a few blocks away and I went over there and he fixed it, changed the string for me. And it turns out he had a son that was a year younger than me that was a really fine bluegrass picker named Bobby Clark. And they had a little bluegrass band that was real similar to probably what Newgrass Revival was, mm-hmm. you know. And they were the really talented, young, up-and-coming bluegrass pickers from that area. And he said, "You ever played any bluegrass?" I said, "No." And he shoved a D-28 in my hand, and away I went. And it felt pretty natural to me. Mm. So then I went on that course for a pretty good while. And just kind of let it lead me. And I discovered guitar players like Doc Watson, you know, mm. Clarence White. And,
sure.
And Tony Rice was the hot guy playing in the 70s, you know.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So all of a sudden then I was involved with all these great young acoustic musicians. That was an amazing era. We were playing those bluegrass festivals in the early 70s. Mark O'Connor was this 12-year-old kid that showed up, and he was that good at 12. Mm. Stuart Duncan, another one of these great kids that was 12 or 13 that was that great as a kid. And
why does bluegrass create these child prodigies?
I don't know.
Ricky Skaggs.
Ricky and Marty Stewart,
all those
all
cats.
All of us were yeah. all...
Such unforgiving... It's not like it's a, you know, you're playing a Les Paul through a Marshall with sustain and volume. Mm-hmm. Like, you're playing the most unforgiving acoustic instrument.
You got to really bring it to
hang.
And playing,
like, as fast as Yngwie Malmsteen or something, you know? It's nuts.
Yeah, and it's really it's kind of a neat... because that music is acoustic and it takes everybody kind of really... Just like anything, you know? But when bluegrass music is played really, really well, it rocks as hard as the Stones.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's a blast to be inside
powerful,
of it.
Powerful. Without and, drums.
Yeah. Well, I like drums, too.
Yeah.
But it's fun. It's funny, in bluegrass, the mandolin player is kind of the drummer.
Mm.
He's keeping the real backbeat, two and four, and driving the band. And it's a unique kind of music. So I headed down that road for many years and left home and started playing. And like I said, I played in the band with Ricky for a while and Jerry Douglas. And all these guys were just phenomenal players at 16, 17 years old. And I was a good singer, so they all liked me to be around. I could sing high and do all that stuff and became a better player. I wasn't on their level in those early years. And then stumbled into the Pure Prairie League gig. Living out in California, I'd gone out there to play with a guy named Byron Berline, who was a really fine fiddle player that was the first call fiddle player on all the LA film dates and record dates, and he played on some Rolling Stones record.
Oh, wow.
And Country Honk, I think it was called. And,
oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
And he was the well-known guy out there, and that was a neat move for me to get out there to the West Coast. And then I started meeting guys like Larry Carlton and Robin Ford, and all just the musicianship that was out there was just through the roof, mm. you know. And just once again, I've kind of always floated in wherever the music wanted to be, and I just tried to be authentic in whatever it was I was around. You know, I got out there and playing with those guys, and they were, you know. You got Larry playing on Steely Dan records and things like that, and you go sit in with people and you want to play something like that, and they go, "Oh, you're the bluegrass country guy. Let's play this," you know. And it was
like, "No, I want to play some Steely Dan."
But
Then Pure Prairie got together out there.
No, they'd been together for a long time.
Okay.
7 or 8 years, and they needed a lead singer.
Oh, so you came in when they were already in. Okay,
and,
okay.
You know, that was fun for a few years, but I didn't see it as being my future.
Right.
You know, and so I tried to get a record deal for a short period of time out in L.A., more as a pop deal, you know, rock, whatever.
So you were already thinking about being a solo artist mm-hmm. at that point.
Yeah, and I thought I'd give it a whirl, and it was... It was not very singer-songwriter driven in the early 80s. You know, it was a little, the folks like, what were they called? Devo, and you know, it was punk, and some of this kind of stuff was all.
Yeah, and all the heavy metal stuff must have been happening all around.
Yeah, and I was
too,
like, no, we're not interested in an overweight guy that sings high.
Try these spandex pants on and come back.
No,
and
not
see
gonna us. Work. And there's a guy that I'd play. Then I started playing with Rodney Crowell, and his guitar player,
and that Roseanne, was the notorious.
The Cherry Bomb, right? The name of the band, and it had some of the premier session guys in Rodney's band. You know, Larry London was the drummer,
right?
Emery Gordy was the bass player. Tony Brown played piano. Hank DeVito and myself, and Albert Lee was in that band at times.
Did you pick up licks from Albert Lee?
All of them. All of them I could, maybe much right. to his chagrin. You know?
Right.
I mean, it was just so good. And the thing that was so cool about what Albert did was it made the most sense to me.
Right.
Being kind of a bluegrass picker, I said, all of this stuff, it all sits in the same world. And I took to it very easily. And I tried to play a lot like him just because it was so good.
Sure.
You know, and why wouldn't you? And he was a big influence on me, and James Burton. And then as I started playing in those days, I really became way more interested in country music than anything else. And Tony signed me to RCA. He said, you should be a country artist. You're not a pop artist.
Right.
And I said, okay. So away I went and struggled for a long time.
And then is that when you moved out to Nashville?
Uh-huh. Moved out to Nashville from L.A. in 83 and struggled for about 7 years.
Really?
Yeah, not much happening. They didn't play the records I was making, and no interest. And I did a lot of session work.
How many solo records did you make before it clicked?
Almost four.
Really?
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's like unheard of nowadays.
You wouldn't get the chance.
That up, or you'd be doing it on an indie label.
Yeah,
whatever,
they wouldn't give you that many chances to fail.
I mean, what was that experience like? Like, what were you just, every time you went in trying new things, or were they like, just stick with what you're doing and it's the public's going to catch up at some point?
We didn't know. Nobody knew. And they never know, even when something's successful.
Right.
I don't think they really know it. They just try. We all just try.
Right.
Some work, some don't. And
you kind of feel it when a song works, don't you?
Yeah. But there's times where you go, I can't believe that wasn't the biggest thing yet,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
But you know, as I look back, honestly, on those records, they're not that good,
right?
You know, and I'm okay with them struggling.
Was that like a scary time in your career?
No, like, did not you ever... really, because I knew I could go play with anybody,
right?
You know, and even in those years, I got an offer from Mark Knopfler to come play with him,
really,
and go tour with him, and I guess it was. Would have been part of Dire Straits, but I'm not exactly sure. That was right on the same time period we started doing his own records and stuff. Yeah.
And then eventually Paul Franklin did do that.
Yeah,
so it's like a connection that needs to happen at some point.
And it was funny because I wasn't making any money to speak of. Session work was keeping me alive and jingles and things like that. But it would have solved everything. Would have been a great payday. But I told Mark, I said, man, I can't bail. If I do this, it's going to take a couple years out of my life.
Right.
I got a new record deal, and I just, if I bail on it, it'd kind of be admitting failure.
Right.
And I said,
I got to take my shot.
I got to keep trying.
Right.
So I turned down the sure thing, you know.
Wow.
Probably the dumbest move you could make, but, you know, I turned down the sure thing and bet on myself.
Yeah.
And then it flipped right after that.
Was there a point in your solo career after having some success that you felt like, okay, like I'm okay. I kind of pulled this off. Like I'm going to be able to do this for a while. Like, do you ever get to that point?
I don't know. You know, I think I was fortunate that I had so much musician in me that none of that stuff ever really made much of an impact, as did neither the failure.
Right.
The failure didn't affect me.
Right.
It didn't bother me because I did know my talent. I said, I can go play in that band if I need to pay for my, you know,
right.
I don't have to be up front.
Right.
And now here I am at 61 and I'm basically a sideman in a really cool band.
Wow.
You know? And it's the best
but you're
band
still
ever,
like
you know?
A mega, you know, country star too.
I still got my past and it works.
Yeah.
But it, you know, wouldn't have seen it coming.
Right.
And the truth is it's I've never really cared where my place was in a setting. I play with a swing band. Me and Paul play in a swing band called the Time Jumpers, and we play Western swing music every Monday night in Nashville, which is insane. Just to tell people, we got a swing band. What? But it's fun. you know, and everybody splits the money up after we get done. Yeah. And you get paid a little.
And that probably keeps you money jazzed up.
Yeah, it's a blast, you know. Yeah. And it just, it keeps, I know I would have done this no matter what.
Right.
If there'd have been no success or tremendous success.
Well, it's funny, you know, I played a show the other night, and this kid, young, like, must have been a teenager, and he had a guitar with him, and he came up to me afterwards, and I was like, hey, can you give me some tips? You know, I want to be a musician, you know, what are some, like, career tips? And I said, oh, man, it's the world, it's so different from when I was your age. No, like, I don't even know where to point you, but I said the most important thing and the only thing that really matters, you do it because you love it, not because of any of that other stuff. Do it because you have to do it, you know? That's why I did it.
Well, me too.
Yeah.
And I knew I would if I was playing Holiday Inns back in Oklahoma City 6 nights a week.
Yeah.
I love playing music. And it, my mom got it, you know, in a really cool way. I think after some success happened for me, she'd occasionally get interviewed by somebody, and she said, they'd ask her, well, what'd you think about your son, you know, and running off to be a musician instead of going to college, getting a real job and doing all that. She goes, I didn't want a rich kid. I wanted a happy kid.
Yeah.
She said, that music made him happy. So that was good enough for me.
That's a good mom.
And it was awesome.
That's a supportive mom right there. Jesus. Let's talk a little bit about your gear.
Sure.
Because people love gear talk. That's like the thing I get requests for more than anything else. So starting with, like, what's your go-to live rig when you go out on tour for your guitar, amp, pedals, all that stuff?
Yeah, I don't know much about all the pedal stuff. I'm very primitive in my knowledge of that stuff. I feel like if it doesn't start as a really great sound from the source, just plugged in and a little bit of verb, if it's not really, really good, a pedal's not going to help at all.
Right.
But I started using this fella's amps named Phil Bradbury. They're called Little Walters.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And they're, you know, another one of those boutique amps, I guess.
Yeah.
But he does them all hand-wired, and they just, you know, it's just a really, once again, it's a really great starting point.
Right. This is a great time for guitar gear.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's sort of like the farmer's market of guitar stuff. You know what I mean? Boutique-y amps, boutique-y guitars, pedals, all that stuff.
And I feel like that gear is like, I look at gear and guitars and all that stuff like a painter would look at the colors of paint that he has to paint with. You wouldn't want to paint with one color all the time.
Sure.
So I like every kind of possible gear. I like every conceivable kind of pickup and just because I never know what color you want to paint with and what's gonna, you know, I think a lot of the real reason to do this is to just play what's necessary, is to find the part that is needed.
Yeah,
we all have a tendency to play too much.
Yeah,
you know,
and guilty.
me too. But as a young musician at a session, you know, it was my turn to play, and away I went. And the producer said, "Oh man, let's try it again." He goes, "That was great." He goes, "This time," he said, "let's try it again." He said, "Just play me half of what you know." And it was the coolest lesson to learn as a kid, you know. And I'm not a, you know, there's a time to be flashy and time to play fast things, but most of the time I'm willing to edit myself all the time by saying, okay, I just played 8 notes. Could I say more with 5?
Right.
And so little by little, it's all about casting away, you know, all the unnecessary stuff.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's a tough lesson to learn.
It's brutal, and there's some people that aren't interested.
Right.
You know, it's and I play to move, and I sing to move, and I listen to music to be moved. Being impressed was fun as a young kid.
Yeah.
To be, wow, the wow factor was great.
Yeah.
But it's not that so much anymore.
Well, here's the thing. Do you ever go on, like, YouTube or whatever and watch people dissect your guitar playing? Because, you know, you are, like, a hugely influential guitar player.
Yeah.
And you can go on YouTube and find a whole bunch of dudes going, like, this is how you play, you know, the lead from this thing.
Get my tone in 9 minutes. Thanks, it only took me 50 years. you've narrowed it down to 9 minutes. You're amazing.
Like, you ever watch those guys and go, like, no, you're doing that all wrong, man. Like, have you ever been inspired to do your own instructional DVD or anything? You're going to keep your secrets to yourself.
I don't have any secrets. I stole everything I learned, you know. But it's, you know, it's what I think what most people really miss the point of is there's a guitar sitting over there. Your hands are going to go on it different than mine do.
Right.
The same instrument, but we're going to sound totally different when we play it.
Yeah.
And I think everybody thinks if I get that amp, I get that guitar, I get that pedal,
totally.
I get that.
Just like Keith Richards.
I will. And, you know, it's funny because I'm really good pals with Keith Urban, and we do a thing every year for benefit for the Hall of Fame. And he and I are the house guitar players for everybody that comes. And it's nice. A blast for us.
I'm sure.
So we just get to play all night. And he got all this Dumbo stuff and da-da-da-da-da. He's all excited, and it's the best thing he's ever heard. And he goes, Vince, come over here and play through this, you know. And so I come to plug in. I start playing. He goes, shit. Said, you just sound like you.
It's all in the hands,
it
baby.
Is. It's all in the midst. Yeah. People's hands are the reason, you know, that things sound the way they do. You know,
it just, and their life experience, all that stuff. You know, it all goes into the soup.
It does, but it's once again, it all has to start from a pretty good place, you know. And being an acoustic musician, I learned a lot about how to get tone out of an instrument, where to play it, how hard to play it,
right.
You know, all that kind of stuff. And it's the same with the electric world. I can pick up an electric guitar and play it acoustically and know right away that it doesn't have much life.
Right.
You know, and even an electric instrument will generally, something I want, will sound pretty good acoustically.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I'm crazy about guitars. I have a insane collection of a little bit of all of it,
right?
You know, and to the point of I should be on an episode of Hoarders or something.
You know what I just did? I just sold 20 of my guitars.
Me too.
Because I've done the same thing, like collected a bunch of stuff over the years, and I got rid of like 20 guitars through that Reverb.com, which is like the greatest website for guitar players ever.
It is.
And I'm gonna take that. You know, we blew them out like in an hour or whatever, and I'm gonna go buy like two.
That's the
nice
deal.
Things,
I'm doing the same thing.
Yeah. Oh, great.
Yeah, the same thing. I got a bunch of stuff at George Gruen's right now.
Nice.
And once again, I've always tried to be real supportive of amp builders, guitar makers, and I've never endorsed anything. And people will come and say, hey, we'd like to make a model. I go, I don't want a model.
Right.
Fender did.
Yeah.
Said, we want to make a model of your Telecaster. I said, dude, I'm already playing a Fender. What good is that going to do you? I'm already doing everything you think this will do.
Yeah.
I said, you're not going to make a good guitar as good as that white 53 Telecaster.
Yeah.
No offense, but you're not, you know. And they said, well, let us try. And they didn't. But, you know, I don't really want any of that. And I'll buy most of the stuff. Somebody's a new guitar builder. I said, let me buy a couple things. You can tell people I'm playing them if you want.
And, right.
But I'm not out there trying to be an endorser of stuff and saying you should play this. I just like to be able to play what I want.
Right.
You know, if you start making deals with companies, then you feel obligated to play their stuff. And I just don't have much interest in that.
Yeah, there's too many guitars out there to limit yourself.
And me and Joe, when we go out, it's pretty fun. You know, we'll make a few guitar shops around the country. And, and he's as nuts about it as me.
Oh, I'm sure. He's got to have some good stuff.
He must.
Hey, when you're sitting down recording a guitar solo, do you sort of map it out? Do you have an idea what you're going to do? Or are you just winging it until you find something that works?
I wing it for the most part. But I think what most people miss in soloing is they lose sense of what the melody is.
Right.
There's a great old Chet Atkins story. He was producing a record, and one of the musicians said, I don't really know what to play here. And Chet said, the melody usually works. And so, even, you know, in ballad playing and stuff, I've always let I just trust my ears as much as anything, but as a player, I try to play something I would sing. And then when I'm singing, I try to sing something I would play. And for that, I'm always kind of conscious of the melody.
Right.
To some degree.
Right.
You know? And then say, what does it need? Does it need the lift? And I feel like soloing is as much about storytelling as the words of the song.
Yeah.
You know, it has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And God knows you'd like to see it go somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, and be moving and do something musical and all those things. And it's fun. You know, I think a lot of times your first instinct is pretty cool.
Right.
You know, yeah. And you'll be doing something and you'll go hack at it for a couple hours and go play me that very first thing I did. You know, and then you go, now that was neat. And then it's all about editing for me. It's all about finding compositionally what's interesting.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And how you know, I'm really particular to a crazy level, you know, of the emotion of a bend. If it goes too fast, I don't want that.
Right.
You know, everything, you know, pocket grease, weight, this, that. You know, Joe is, I love playing with him because he is, you know, I think he's underrated to some degree in, right. in the world.
No, he's a monster player.
He is, but he's
slide playing too.
He plays with such great restraint.
Right.
And that's what I like, you know, a lot of patience.
Yeah.
You know, he's not out there whittly
right.
all the time.
Right.
You know,
yeah, sure.
It's a blast. I sit
it's
over
the
there.
The space.
Yeah.
You know?
And then
yeah.
he just plays something and I just start laughing. Go, where did that come from? You know, and I think I'm more interested in that, you know, than somebody, you know. And the same with singing. You know, I don't want to hear a singer sing everything they've got in the first two lines of the song. Then where's
right.
it going to go?
Right.
You know, where what's left and all of it, you know, it's.
I think country music is like an amazing, it's like a music, it's a genre of restraint played by all these people who are virtuosos. It's a funny thing.
Well, sure.
The level of musicianship in country music, and I say this as somebody that came up in rock and
yeah.
punk rock and all that stuff, so I can say this, absolutely. The level of musicianship in country music is like monumental. It's just gigantic compared to everything else.
Yeah, and it's very chameleonish in that they can go wherever you want.
Right. But it's like this, there's like a restraint and a discipline to
mm-hmm.
it. Like kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like everybody's just going all the time. It's usually
yeah.
the exact opposite.
And the drawback to that sometimes can be the formula
mm-hmm.
of everybody. You know, there's times where we'll be working on a song and we'll be tracking. And then it gets to the end and say you've got a 2-minute fade and you're gonna play over it or whatever. And then it just then it gets free, you know. And I will say, hey, let's see if we can start here, where we're all free, and then
right.
see where it goes.
Yeah.
And it never works, but I always try, you
yeah.
know. But that's a testament into the restraint and the way that they do that is pretty magical. Everybody's listening to each other,
right?
You know, what you play just inspires what I play, and it just it's democratic,
right?
You know, in the coolest way. That's I talk about that word democracy, and I just go, that's about the only place I see it where it really is.
Why it really
where
works.
It really works.
Yeah,
is what the word intended it to be.
Right, right.
You know, but it's when everybody listens to each other, you know, and you play with guys that are used to getting a great cue mix and not a more me thing where all anybody's listening to is
yeah.
themselves and the click track and oh I'm right in time and I'm right you know when it's all doing this, man, it took me
a long time. It was like years into playing and making records and stuff that really as a lesson clicked for me. Like, wait, I gotta listen to what the rhythm section's doing. What
yeah.
am I doing over here, you know?
Yeah. It's real easy to kinda get in your own world and
yeah.
I'm doing my thing, but that's, you know, that's the great part is sometimes you can take a record and strip everything away and pull up one guy's part and go, oh, there's your whole record right there.
Right.
That's the coolest part on the record. Then you pull this up and go, no, that's the coolest part on the
yeah,
record.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's pretty neat when people listen to each other, how good it can be.
So you've had obviously a very long career. You've been around country music or just music in general for a long time, but country music in particular. See it go through all these different phases, you know,
mm-hmm.
and in the modern era, you know, you got alt country and you got bro country and you
mm-hmm.
got pop, hip hop country, just all these different, you know, sort of subgenres
yeah.
within it or whatever. So, like, where do you see it going and who do you like? Who do you listen to that are like the young up and comers?
My favorite kid to come along in Nashville in a long, long, long time is this kid named Charlie Warsham.
Oh, I just played a gig with Charlie.
He's amazing.
He's incredible. Yeah, and what a sweet dude.
Yeah. I keep teasing him. I said, I wish you were my kid.
He's ripping guitar player. He's incredible. Everything.
Yeah. He's just, and they won't give him the time of day. It reminds me of me. That he's such a great singer, great player, great writer, all these things. And they're all interested in the flavor of the month, of what's current and what's going on, and he doesn't fit that, so it's a struggle for him. But I've been really, you know, I just tell him all the time, I said, man, be patient,
right?
Because you have what they all kind of wish they did,
right?
You know, just really great God-given talent, and
and
people will continue to take a chance on you because you're talented,
right?
You're not popular, but you're talented,
right?
So you always have gonna have a leg up. And he's a great kid. I like him a lot, but in our world. And Chris Stapleton is obviously blowing the doors off of everything.
Sure,
and
sure.
We've been friends for a long time and written some songs together.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
He's
really talented. And you just knew if you give people the chance to hear his voice, it's undeniable.
Yeah.
Game over. Okay.
His whole story is so amazing that he could get through, you know, the machine, you know, he sort of sidestepped it in a weird way.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. And finally, maybe, you know, there was only really one way to make it work for the longest time. You had to get a record deal. You had to work your way through and maybe get a record on the radio, and that would lead to this and this and this and this. And it's not so much that way anymore. It's kind of transitional.
Right.
It's not another way yet either, you know, both ways are still in play, so to speak. But I just, you know, I don't mind it changing and evolving and all that stuff that it does, because to me, all those kids are doing is being musical, you know. They're being creative my parents didn't like the stuff I listened to.
Sure.
Either. You know, I'm 61. Yeah. I'm not supposed to like what.
Totally. What a lot I say of that to kids my kids all doing, the time, man. You know? I say that all
and
the
it's
time.
It's not personal.
Right.
And so I've never been one of those that, oh, it's got to be traditional to be any good. That's short sighted and not very smart. So I've always been open book, man. If it's good, I like it.
Yeah. You seem like a guy, like, scandal-free. Like, you don't seem like a guy that's, like, abused yourselves over the years, like, in the sort of stereotypical cliche country icon Hank Williams sort of thing. Like, I don't get the sense you're ever going to become an episode of Tales from the Two of Us or whatever. Like, how have you, you know, you're on tour right now, you're watching golf. You're not, like, shooting a speedball or whatever in your room on your time off. How have you sort of navigated the muddy waters of temptation out there over the years?
Fear. Fear is a great motivator. My father was an iron-fisted, you know, tough guy, you know. And I never had any interest in drugs. I've never smoked any pot, which is really weird, you know.
In this business, Jesus,
yeah, no
man.
Kidding. And I quit drinking over 30 years ago. I didn't even like drinking.
Right.
I did a little bit. I like margaritas with Mexican food,
yeah,
you know, because it tasted like lemonade. And I never liked the taste of liquor. And I just, you know, always been a happy guy. Love jokes. I love to laugh.
Right.
I don't take it too much too serious. And I married a great woman. And you know, it's just been lucky to avoid a lot of that stuff. I mean, I've made just as many mistakes in my own way as anybody else has.
Sure.
Learned from them. And it just, it's the only time I tell my kids, too. I said, you're not going to learn anything until you screw something up.
Right.
Once you make a mistake, then you'll learn something. It's not about being perfect. Perfect sounds so boring.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I wasn't going to do is when I was a teenager, my brother had a real bad drinking problem and probably died because of it, you know, of abusing himself in that way. So I saw firsthand what that looked like, and it didn't have much appeal to me.
Yeah.
But you know, all in all, it's okay. And I think the most important thing is that I don't have judgment towards anybody else that does whatever they want to do.
Right.
Ever. You know, I just, hey, you're you and I'm me. I'm easy. So.
Yeah. Cool, man. Well, that's all I got, man. Okay. Thanks for doing this today.
Yeah,
it's fun. I will be patiently waiting for that instructional DVD.
All right, that was Vince Gill on Walking the Floor. I got one thing to say about Vince Gill. That man is pure class. Classy man. All right, get on over to walkingthefloor.com. I'm going to put some links up to things we talked about and Vince's website and goings-on and tour dates and all that sort of stuff so you can go catch him out on the road or buy his T-shirt or listen to his streams or whatever the case may be. And when you're done with that, make sure you get on over to all the old episodes of Walking the Floor. They all live in Spotify. They live in the iTunes store. They live wherever you stream your podcasts. And when you're done listening to all 121 of those, make sure you get on over to the Spotify Walking the Floor playlist. It's the home of the best country music, roots, and Americana, and whatnot, and so forth and so on. Press subscribe. We need subscribers. Okay, boys and girls, that's it for this week. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. This has been another fine episode of Walking the Floor with me, Chris Shiflett. Adios, amigos!